I will recite Om three times. So take a deep breath in. To open the eyes softly now. And namaste, and thank you all very much once again for giving me this wonderful opportunity to share whatever little I know about yoga. We'll do that. Yeah, so it's always a pleasure to talk about yoga. And I understand that you already have some background to Yoga Sutras. But before we start, you know, I noticed that, you know, you mentioned that there was a chant behind me. Do you guys want to chant it?
Yeah.
Okay.
We are practicing just for
so
you.
So just repeat it after me then.
This one right
yeah.
here?
Okay. Om Bhurbhuvah Svaha. Repeat. Do you want to repeat?
Yeah, let's repeat first.
Okay. Om Bhurbhuvah Svaha. Tatsaviturvarenyam.
Tatsaviturvarenyam.
Bhargo devasya dhimahi.
Bhargo devasya dhimahi.
Dhiyo yo nah prachodayat. Very good. Excellent. So you guys did work on it, looks like. It's a good sign. Okay, so now whenever we do any study of Patanjali, there is it's like an invocation to Patanjali. So we always start with this invocation. Any discussion, any study of Patanjali always starts with this. Okay, so let's just close the eyes, and I'm just going to sing it. It has a little tune to it, and I'll just sing it. You listen in, okay? Or you can just read it, you know, on the screen while I'm singing it. Yogena chittasya padena vacham. Malam sharirasya cha vaidyakena yopakarottam pravaram muninam patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi. Okay, so that's the invocation to Patanjali that we always start with. So one of you can read the translation in English.
I respectfully bow down and fold in hand and offer my prayers to Saint Patanjali, the highest among the
Munis,
who has presented the remedies for removing the impurities of the body through his treatise. On Ayurveda, of language through his treatise on grammar.
That's Patanjala Mahabhashya.
Yes, and the impurities of the chitta mind field through his treatise on yoga sutras of Patanjali.
So, as you can see, Patanjali is given credit for three things that he has given to the humankind. One is the whole medical science of Ayurveda. Okay, that came from him. Anybody heard the term Ayurveda? Oh, all of you have. Okay, wonderful. So this whole science of medicine, he is credited with bringing us the original text of Ayurveda. He also has the most authoritative and the most detailed commentary on the Sanskrit grammar. Okay, so for purifying the speech, he has given us this Sanskrit grammar. And to purify the mind, we know what he has given us, right? And that's what we're working on. So the whole purpose of yoga, as we can see, is to purify the mind of all the impurities. So when we talk of the impurities, what are we talking about? What are the impurities of the mind? What are we talking about?
Attachments.
What else?
Aversions.
Definitely. What else?
Ignorance.
Absolutely.
Ego.
Everything. Basically, all the negative stuff that we have, you know, in all of the above, plus things like anger, greed, jealousy, hatred, okay, and any kind of depression, anxiety, all negative stuff. That's all called the impurities of the mind. And unless we purify the mind of all these impurities, we can never find peace of mind. Okay, because peace of mind is what everyone wants, is the objective of yoga also. So objective of yoga is completely tuned into what everyone wants, right? Peace of mind, calmness, stability, serenity of the mind, that's all we are looking for. So that's the purpose of yoga. And the definition of yoga, as I'm sure you've done that. So what's the definition of yoga? I'm looking for the exact sutra in the Yoga Sutra that you might have studied, which defines yoga. Okay, I'll give you a hint. It's sutra number 2 in chapter 1.
Yoga is to still the pattern of consciousness.
Right. So it's the stilling the mind, basically, all the perturbations and agitation that goes on in the mind, how to still that? That is called that's termed as yoga in the Yoga Sutras. Now that is one sutra that I always recommend that you memorize in Sanskrit, because that's really the key sutra which will help you, you know, stay cognizant of your goal in practicing yoga, right? So is it okay if we repeat it? All right. So the sutra is Yogas Chitta Vritti Nirodhaha. All right. So you want to repeat it after me? Yogas
Chitta
Vritti
Nirodhaha.
Now that dha, remember I talked about? It is not two separate sounds, dha and ha. It is dha, one sound. There you go. Beautiful. You got that? Yes.
Dha.
Yes. So, let's do it one more time.
Yogash.
Chitta. Vritti. Nirodhaha.
Nirodhaha.
You need to work on it.
I'm sorry. Could you repeat it one more time? I'd like to write it down.
Yogash. It should be in your text. Yogash.
You don't have the Sanskrit there.
I can
give you...
Oh, you guys don't have the Sanskrit?
Ramaswamy does.
How can you study Yoga Sutra without the Sanskrit?
Because we...
Okay. Yogash Chitta Vritti Nirodha. So it's basically what it's saying is, you guys ready?
Yes.
Okay. So the definition of yoga is in this sentence, chitta vritti nirodha. Those are the three words that define yoga. Chitta is the mind, or the mind stuff, some people like to call it. Vritti is whatever is happening in the mind. What are the perturbations, changes, anything that's happening in the mind is a vritti. Every moment things are happening, every moment there is a vritti being produced, right? And nirodha is the ability to control it, to do a cessation, moderation, whatever. You know, there are several words that people have used. Every commentator has used a different word to describe that. Okay. So if I were to use an English sentence using Sanskrit words, yoga by definition is the ability to do a nirodha of the vrittis of the chitta. Okay, so that would be an English sentence using Sanskrit words. It means yoga is the ability to calm the fluctuations, the changes that are constantly going on in the mind. Okay. Now the very next sutra is, and I'm not going to have to ask you to repeat that, but the next one is tada drashtuhu swarupe vasthanam. What that means is that when you are able to calm the mind, when you are able to apply what we just said in the sutra number 2, then the drashtu, which is the observer, the seer, can rest in its own true nature. What does that mean to anybody? When the mind is calm, then the seer can rest in its own true nature. That's the second, the number 3 sutra. What does that mean?
Just be.
Observer, the seer, drashta is observer. Who is the observer? What is the observer? Who is the observer? What is the observer? Who's observing what? Who?
Oh, I thought you meant the yogi that has achieved the peace of mind.
Yeah.
Is observing.
Yeah.
Their connection to the spiritual world, like dissociating from.
Getting close? You're getting close? You're getting close?
We're just observing.
Who is the observer and what's the observed? Who is the observed? Sarah, is it okay if I digress a little? Because this is important.
Yeah, I think... Yeah. I want them to answer because I think they both talked about this. I know you guys know the answer.
I know. Isn't it the same thing? The observer is observing themselves.
Go ahead and digress.
Okay, you know, I need to, because this is important to understand. This concept is very, very central to understanding the yoga philosophy. So the digression takes us into another philosophy, and the name of that philosophy is Sankhya, S-A-N-K-H-Y-A, Sankhya philosophy. It is that philosophy on which Patanjali based his Yoga Sutras. It's a much older philosophy called the Sankhya philosophy. According to the Sankhya philosophy, there are two entities. Okay? So according to this philosophy, there are two entities. And these two entities are the increase the size here.
Okay, we just spent all day asking.
We
talked
about this so much.
You have talked about it.
Wait, so I was like, come on.
We know what you're talking about.
Okay, so these are the two entities that are given in the Sankhya philosophy as the two independent and entities which have no beginning and no end. Beginningless, and they will never end. What's Purusha now? That's what we want to know. What's Purusha?
Is that the spiritual?
Hmm?
Is that the spiritual?
That's the spirit. Not spiritual, it's the spirit. It's called many different names, Atma, soul, spirit, consciousness, the being, you know, different names depending on what you read and what context it is written as, okay? Basically just the pure consciousness, all right? And what's Prakriti? Everything else, everything that we can feel, touch, think about, material counterpart, so to say. This body, this mind, this intellect, this material universe, all that is, the collection of all that is called Prakriti.
It's like the senses.
Hmm?
Like the senses, I guess.
Everything.
Yeah.
Sense is a part of that. Now, but also, you know, we need to understand that Prakriti, you know, when we talk of the human being, for example, right? As per the Sankhya philosophy, the human being is a composite of 23 elements. 23. Okay? And we need to know that because, you know, when we get into this concept of samadhi and all that, those will be required. What are the 23 elements that the human system is a composite of? So, we start with this most subtle level, and then go from the subtle to the more grosser levels. Okay, at the subtlest level, it's called the intellect. The intellect is the subtlest of all. Intellect. Okay, the next one is called ego. Did you talk about all that? Okay. Intellect, ego, and then the third is called the mind. And I'll explain all that after we list the 23 elements. So there's intellect, the ego, the mind. Then we have the five senses, sense perceptions. The sense of touch, taste, smell, etc. All that. You know the five senses, right? Now, for each of the five senses, there is a corresponding sense organ. So, for example, for the sense of smell, you have the organ of nose. For the sense of hearing, the organ of the ears, etc. All right? So, five senses and five sense organs. Then there are five organs of action. What are these five organs of action? Did you talk about that?
No, we did. We actually, like, this was one of the sutras that I was a little stuck on, so I'm glad that you're talking about this. This is what I said yesterday, it was confusing.
So, the five organs of action are hands for lifting things, throwing things, that's it, hands and arms, that's one. Then feet and legs for kicking, moving, running, doing all the other stuff. Okay, that's the second one. The third, the most dangerous one, is to abuse people. You know, you so and so. You know, I'm going to, you know, the
use
tongue.
People, you said abuse people.
I just jokingly said that. Speech.
I was like,
What I said was, you know, it's the most dangerous one because people use all kinds of speech to hurt people. So I'm just joking. So tongue, basically the third organ of action to produce speech. The fourth are the organs of elimination. Okay. And fifth is the organs of reproduction. So these are called the five organs of action. Okay, so far we have totaled how many? 18, right? If you can count, all right? Five more left? Should be a good guess by now. Five gross elements. Earth, water, air, fire and ether. That's it. Very good. So these 23 elements are what we are composed of. The Sankhya philosophy also tells us that before this whole thing came into being, the Prakriti was in a state of perfect balance. Perfect balance. What does that mean? Now, there are three gunas. Anybody heard the term gunas? Sattva, rajas and tamas? Okay. Now, these three gunas, as you may have heard, they are in a constant state of movement. They are constantly moving, changing themselves. One is dominant at one time, the next one will be dominant in the next moment. It keeps changing. The dominance is shifting from moment to moment. But there is a definition. How it is defined, nobody tells you. The Sankhya philosophy doesn't tell you how it is defined, what that state of balance is. But at the beginning of this creation, they were in a state of balance. When they are in a state of balance, nothing can be produced. This whole body cannot be produced. These 23 elements cannot be produced in a state of balance. So that's when they are in the state of balance, that's called the original Mula Prakriti. That's the root of the Prakriti, or the original state of Prakriti, when nothing has taken place and yet it is there. Because it's an independent entity. It's always there. But it's always there in the state of balance. Only when there is an imbalance, rajas dominates a little bit, creation happens. Everyone get that? These are concepts which you have to spend some time understanding, okay? But I need to go through this because this will happen, you know, this will appear later on. All right? And then, of course, this entire Prakriti, everything, including our intelligence, intellect, they are non-conscious. They don't have a consciousness of their own. Intellect works based on borrowing the consciousness from Purusha. Purusha is the only conscious entity, and the human intellect works through a reflection of that consciousness, which is given by Purusha. All right. In our current state, what is happening is this Purusha has been confused. It's confused. It doesn't know what its true identity is because it has been, so to say, it has been mixed with the ego, basically, ego and the intellect. They are kind of superimposed on each other. The Purusha, or the soul, has been superimposed on the ego. Or the ego, well, that's the other way around. The ego, etc., has been superimposed on the Purusha. And Purusha's identity is all messed up. It doesn't know what its true identity is. At the truest level, I am nothing but this pure consciousness. I am nothing else. But it's all messed up because of the ego and the intellect being, you know, what they are. When that happens, I don't know what my true identity is. So what Patanjali is telling us, that when you're able to still the fluctuations of the mind, only then the observer, which is the Purusha, can know what my true identity is. Otherwise, it is completely messed up by the ego.
Can you say that one more time? Only the observer can know.
The only time the observer can know what its true identity is, when the mind has been totally stilled of all the fluctuations, of all the agitation, that it normally goes through. And when that happens, when you know that you are, what your true identity is, then the ego loses its power over us. Okay? So that's the second statement we said, that the observer can now rest in its own true nature, because now there is nothing to color it. So to understand, you know, how the whole thing functions, you know, obviously if you want to still the mind, if you want to control the fluctuations of the mind, our first job is to understand the mind. What the mind does, how it functions, and that's pretty much most of the stuff that's in the Yoga Sutras, you know, to try and explain what the mind is. But at a simplistic level, they say, you know, these commentators and in the other texts, it's a good idea to again think of the mind as these four functions now. Okay, four functions being the intellect. We already talked about that: intellect, ego, mind, and the fourth function is the memory, which in that listing is a part of the ego. But to understand these functions, you know, it's a good idea to separate the function of the memory. So there are four functions of the mind: the mental function, the ego, the intellect, and the memory. Right? The mental function does what? The mind. What does the mind do?
Think,
gather input through the five senses, send out messages through the hands, arms, legs, etc. Right, motor action, as it's called. So those are the functions of the mind. Also to worry about things, all those things. Okay. What's the function of the intellect?
To learn. And know.
Intellect is, the main function of the intellect is to?
Reason.
Is to reason out and then make the appropriate choices from among whatever options that you're offered. At every step in life, we are offered options, multiple options to choose from, right? And it's the intellect's job to provide answers. What does the ego do?
Cause suffering.
Ego causes suffering. How? Yes. So, the purpose for which ego is there is to create an identity. At every moment, we need to know what our function is, what our role in life is. Okay. At this time, the ego tells us that my job is to be a student of yoga. And at another time, ego might tell you that you are the teacher. You are the mother, you are the husband, you are the father, you are a caretaker, you are the CEO of this company. All that is the job of the ego, to help us understand our identity at a given time. So how does it cause suffering? Because it is going beyond its assigned role. Because it is going beyond its assigned responsibility and takes on the job of the intellect. Now, every time, every moment in life, something happens, right? Every moment. Let's call that as an experience. Everything that happens is an experience. We are in this class now, that will be recorded as an experience. Right? And in our memory, there's a record of all this going on. Does everyone understand that? No? You're lost? Okay. All right. I'm trying to see if we need to get it.
What?
Sure.
Yeah.
Should we go on with this discussion, or? Because it looks like some of you are losing me. You're okay.
Yeah, I'm just writing. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
I did want to ask you something about when you were talking about the ego. So the ego's job is to create an identity. And when the ego causes suffering when it takes on the job of the intellect. And from there that. So you're
going to
tell us how that works.
Let me take you through a scenario, okay? That will help you understand how these four things function together, you know? So let's say at the end of... I do this fairly frequently. Let's say at the end of the day, you know, job, you're coming back home after work, kind of hungry, and automatically you're driven toward the kitchen, you know? And the moment you enter the kitchen area, you start smelling something, okay? And so what I'm getting to is, you know, the mind is now beginning to gather information through the five senses. So the first sense that gets engaged, even from a distance, is the sense of smell. And then you go to the kitchen countertop, and then you see a piece of cake sitting there. Okay. Now your sense of sight has been engaged. And your immediate desire is to engage the sense of touch because you want to dip your finger into that cake, feel its texture maybe, see how it feels, you know, what it feels like, etc. And what goes on after that?
Taste.
Put it in your tongue to engage the sense of taste. So now, at this point, by this time, the mind has all the information that it needs and there are options at this point. What are the options? Eat it or not to eat it. Okay, so these are the two options. And who is the decision maker? Who decides what to do at a given time?
Intellect.
The intellect. So the mind has to give all this information to the intellect. To please tell me what I should do. Mm-hmm. Any of you knows computer science or no? No, don't worry. Okay, so the intellect... You know, he gets the information, but in our current state of being, unfortunately, the intellect thinks that it has the boss in the name of ego. Okay, so it has to go and knock on ego's door. Hey, boss, what should I do? This is what I've been told. So ego says, hold on, let me go into my memory bank. I'll look up stuff because every decision has to be based on memory. Every decision. Looks into the memory bank and what does it find? An instance of a similar cake that we ate about a week ago. And then it was smart enough to put a label against it. And that label read, Divine Experience. Divine. It's the most delightful experience ever. So ego says, hey buddy, it's very simple. Read the label and tell the mind to activate whatever you need to do, right? Intellect goes back into its chamber and says, I am the decision maker. I need to do some private investigation. You know, let me just give it one more thought. How do you do the investigation? Memory, right? Dip into the memory, another instance comes up. What was that? A visit to the doctor 5 days ago. Based on my blood work, my cholesterol levels came out to be sky high. My doctor said, you're very close to having a heart problem. Go check with your nutritionist. So I had a visit with my nutritionist 2 days ago. Guess what she said?
No more cake.
Don't eat the cake.
Don't eat the cake. Don't eat the cake. It can cause heart problems. And obviously the intellect is alarmed. It goes back to boss, look what I find. I'm not supposed to eat this cake. Guess what the boss says?
I don't care.
You stupid idiot. Don't you read the label? It says divine experience. One piece of cake. Has one piece of cake hurt anybody ever in this life?
Not that I'm aware of.
Not that, right?
I mean, not just the one.
You're allergic or something.
But it's not just the one piece of cake we're talking
about. You got the message now. Yeah. You get the message. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You understand what's going on in life. Mm-hmm. This is happening every day in every situation in life. We have a situation, we have some options. Guess who raises his ugly head? Ego. I want you to do this. Intellect says, yes, boss, I'll do it.
That was such a great way to describe that. Like, I feel you now.
Yeah.
So in the perfect scenario, it would just be the mental function going directly to the intellect instead of going through. But now the ego, instead of the mental function goes to the intellect, then the intellect turns to the ego.
Ego, because intellect has
a circle going on instead
yes.
of... Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. So the message here obviously is that in our current state, ego is the dominant factor, whereas we want to shift that dominance to the intellect. And that is the whole purpose of the practice of yoga. That is the whole purpose of the practice of yoga, is to eventually shift the dominance to the intellect. Make it sharp enough so that it is not disturbed by the ego. Okay, that's the main job of the practice of yoga.
Okay.
All right.
Or dominated, disturbed, or even dominated, we could even say.
Ego is the dominant.
Yeah, and that's right. And so we're trying to get away from
that dominance.
Dominating. Yeah. Okay.
So we want the intellect.
We still want the ego.
We want the ego, but we want the ego to tell us what the job is that we're doing, but not make decisions on its own.
Yeah.
Having determined that I am a mother at this time, transfer the control over to the intellect and let the intellect decide what it wants to do as the mother at that given time. Right? So, then you guys have talked about the 8 limbs of yoga. Okay, in the last few days, Sarah told me that you've been working. What are the 8 limbs of yoga? Let's go through it quickly. 8 limbs.
The yamas.
Yamas, uh-huh. Niyamas, uh-huh.
Asana.
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 No, no, no. Before that. Asana. Then next one is? Pranayama. Pranana, that sound with the tip of the tongue all the back. Pranayama. Okay, next one. Pratyahara. Pratyahara. Then next one. Dharana. Dhyana.
Samadhi.
Okay, so these are the 8 limbs of yoga. Now, you know, Patanjali introduces the 8 limbs of yoga in a very beautiful sutra. Very beautiful. Okay. And I believe it's number 28 in chapter 1. Either 27 or 28. Let me read the Sanskrit first,
okay.
Then you can read the English translation.
Okay.
Okay. So in Sanskrit it goes like this. Yoganga anushthanat ashuddhikshaye jnana deeptihi avivek khyatehe. And I want you to read this meaning, but very carefully. Because it is a very beautifully loaded, pregnant sutra, tells a lot about yoga. Okay? So please read that. Somebody can read it loud.
You said 28.
I believe so.
Through repetition, its meaning becomes clear.
Chapter 1, let me see.
Chapter 1.
I may have mentioned it wrong. Hold on. Is it maybe 38?
Okay.
No, I forget.
Is it the 8 components of yoga? Is that what it
is? Hmm?
Eight components of yoga are...
Sorry. Chapter 2.
Chapter 2.
It's chapter 1. It's chapter 2.
Okay. Am I reading the right thing? The eight components of yoga are external discipline, internal discipline, posture...
No, before that.
When the components of yoga are practiced,
yes,
impurities dwindle. Then the light of understanding can shine forth, illuminating the way to discriminative awareness.
Right. Now, that's a very, like I said, it's a very beautiful, loaded, and pregnant sutra, full of meaning. Mm-hmm. Okay, and it's instructive to just go through that sutra once, you know. So, what it says is, yogang anushthana. Anushthana is the practice. So, by practicing these eight limbs of yoga, that's what it says. By practicing these eight limbs of yoga, all the impurities of the mind and the body, impurities of the mind and the body will dwindle down, will go down, will diminish. Okay? And we talked about the impurities, all the impurities that we talked about. Physical, physiological, mental, emotional, everything. Okay? So all the impurities of the mind will diminish. Jnana deepti, jnana means knowledge. The true intuitive wisdom will shine through. See, right now, that intuitive wisdom cannot shine through because ego puts a lid on it. Ego does not want you to look at that intuition. You get the idea? Because ego is so dominant. Why ego doesn't want you to do that? Because then ego, if it loses power, it can no longer point fingers. Okay, it can never say, you are the cause of my problems, you made me suffer, and you did this, and you did that. That's what the ego does. If you lift that cover from that light of true wisdom, ego has no role to play. So, that light of pure, undiluted wisdom, so to say, it shines through. Then what happens? Viveka khyati. That means now, at that point, you begin to realize exactly who you are, and you are able to you have the best discriminatory function in your intellect. You know exactly what's right, what's wrong, what's real, what's unreal, what's pure, what's unpure, impure. You know all that then. Okay, so this is the promise that Patanjali makes. He says, by practicing these eight limbs of yoga, you will get to that state of self-realization. Because all your impurities have gone, and you have now access to that light, that pure, beautiful light of wisdom, and you can now discriminate between right and wrong. So that is the beauty of these eight limbs of yoga. Okay, so that's a very important sutra. You should kind of keep revisiting it. Okay?
Ramaswamy said, like, many, many lifetimes. How would you know if you got to that? Like, how would you come to that realization?
How do you come to that? Practicing the eight limbs of yoga. That's what Patanjali says.
Like, how would you as a person know that? Like,
you will know that because when you come to that state, right, your ego is not going to bother you then. Okay? At that time, you are able to, you know, there is a term in computers they call WYSIWYG, what you see is what you get. Totally uncluttered. So if you are able to look at things without any coloring from your memories, negative stuff. Okay? From all the, you mentioned the term likes and dislikes, etc., right? If you can look at things without being colored by those things in the memory, then you're good to go. Then you're able to see things exactly in their true color, true nature, without ego putting their label on it. Okay? This is a glass of water. Okay? This is water. This is a cup of tea. It's in a cup, and the tea is this color. It has a certain taste. What does the ego do? I love this tea. I love this coffee. I hate water when it has nothing in it. That's what the ego does. Ego puts it.
So it's just like...
It's just a plain glass of water. Yeah. It's water. Water is supposed to have no taste, you know, but it gives me coolness, freshness. I drink it. This is coffee. It tastes like this. And it gives me freshness, whatever it does. But I love it. I must have it now because I liked it last time. I have to have that. And that becomes a habit then. You have it again, you like it again, you have it again, more. Becomes a habit. Now it's impossible to break that habit. Who did that? Ego.
Now I understand why it would take many, many lifetimes, because I would never, I don't think I would. Letting go of the label.
That's the whole point.
Like almost.
Hey guys, you've already understood the concept of yoga now. This is it. Letting go of those labels. That's it.
Wow, yeah.
That's all there is to yoga.
And what would you call it? I was trying to take notes, so forgive me, I missed it.
Please. Okay, that's another thing I would have to emphasize. Please ask questions.
Okay, thank you.
And as often as you need to. Yeah. So, it doesn't matter if I finish everything that's on my slides. It's not important for me. I assume it's not for you also. More important is to understand these concepts.
When you said when you can look at things without the color of memory,
mm-hmm.
without ego's label, you are then... Where are you?
Then what happens is then ego is playing its role properly. It's giving the identification, but now it's letting the intellect do that job. Let the intellect read those labels if it needs to. It will have to need many times. It needs to read the labels, right? But then it's not going to be driven by, you know, those strong desires and hatreds and likes and dislikes and all that. It's going to make a pure decision based on whatever it is. If I touch a very hot plate, it's going to put a label, dangerous. Okay? Now, intellect needs to read that label so you don't put your hand back on that hot plate again.
So if you're not using ego as like a labeling tactic, what is the function of the ego once you let go of?
Once you let go of it, then the function of the ego is to give you an identity, okay? I am in front of my kids. Ego says, you are the mother at this point, okay? And these are the responsibilities of the mother. Let's transfer the function to the intellect. Let that intellect decide what you should do as a mother. What the ego is going to say, if it is given the choice, your room is so dirty, I told you not to keep it dirty. But mom, I had no time. It doesn't matter. I'm your mother. I'm telling you not to make it dirty. Just clean it up. Fight. If the intellect takes over, I'm just picking up a scenario, right? It might say, you know, your room looks dirty. Can we clean it? Let me help you.
Basically just rationality.
Okay? Instead of making those judgmental decisions, I'm your mother, therefore I'm the boss. You have to listen to me.
His book talks about being present only in the moment. When you wash the dish, you are washing the dish and only washing the dish. Is that tying into that?
Yes, it's rough. It's roughly the same idea all over, right? You, as long as you are able to maintain your presence in the present moment, then you're basically, what you're doing is not letting the ego pull those labels out. Because the labels are in the past.
I'm not saying I don't like washing.
Okay.
It makes me think of something sometimes that, and just as an idea of what happens, like as a mom, sometimes I would feel like I wasn't, my ego would tell me that I'm not as good as someone who's doing in the professional field because I'm home changing diapers. Or it makes you feel less. The ego can make you feel like you're not as good as another person, right? And create judgments and create anger and hostility and resentment and all those things.
Absolutely.
But if you're in the present, it's okay. I am the mom at this moment, like you said a few minutes ago.
This is it.
And that's it.
And that's my job and my intellect.
Be happy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Be contented.
Be content.
That's what it is all about. Okay? Everyone okay so far?
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, these eight limbs of yoga Patanjali has given us, he says, practice these. Before that, in chapter 1, he also mentioned two more words I need to just go over that. It's very important to understand. Abhyasa and Vairagya. You recall that? Those two words? I'm sure Sarah mentioned those.
Yeah, I talked about that, yeah.
Okay. So what in chapter 1, what it says is that look, there are all these fluctuations of the mind constantly going on in the mind. And you need these two things so that you can calm your mind. Those two things are, one he calls abhyasa and the other he calls vairagya. Abhyasa is constant practice, practicing constantly. And there is a very beautiful definition of abhyasa in one of these sutras. I think it's chapter 1 now, 14 or 13 or something like that, I forget.
13 is practice, is the sustained effort to rest in that stillness.
And then next one.
The next one is, this practice becomes firmly rooted when it is cultivated skillfully and continuously for a long time.
And that long time, okay, as Sarah mentioned, could translate into multiple lifetimes. That's what that long time means. Uninterrupted, long time, and with a sense of devotion and respect. Commitment. That's practice. Okay, and then the next one he says is a vairagya, which is non-attachment or detachment. Okay? Do you kind of understand the difference between the two? Non-attachment and detachment? What is it?
Like being attached to life. Like the fear of death, but not attachment.
No, I'm talking of two things, non-attachment and detachment.
Detachment would be like aversion.
Detachment, you have to remove yourself from
the right. So I'm attached to this cup of tea. I'm already attached to it. I must have it at 10 o'clock in the morning, otherwise I'm going to have a headache. That's attachment. You are already attached. Detachment means I want to get away from this now. Get away from this habit. That's detachment. Non-attachment, I've never had this coffee or this tea. I don't want to be attached to it anyway. Okay, I like it, but drink it, enjoy it, but don't put that beautiful label there. That's non-attachment. Alright? So those are the things that Patanjali said you absolutely have to have, practice and this sense of non-attachment. Okay, to make any progress in your pursuits of yoga. All right. So now we can move on to the eight limbs of yoga. And the eight limbs, as we already listed, are the five yamas, five niyamas. Does everyone know the five yamas and niyamas? You remember them or no?
Not like names off the top of my head, but yes, we went over them.
You went over them, okay. Mm-hmm. All right. And then, you know, the asana practice. What's asana in that context?
Like seat.
Asana is?
Seat, the practice.
Positions.
Position.
Hmm?
Postures, positions that receive.
Postures, sitting posture. Asana is a sitting posture. Okay, it comes from the root word as, which means to sit down. And asana is a sitting posture. It also means what you're sitting on. So, for example, this bolster at this point is my asana. Okay, so asana is what you're sitting on, as well as the sitting posture, but it's a sitting posture. So, how did the warrior pose become an asana? That's a later development, you know. Instead of giving it different names, they said, let's give it the same name, keep the name, asana. We call everything as asana now. The original meaning of asana is sitting posture. Pranayama is all the breathing practices, you know that. What's pratyahara, number five? Pratyahara?
No.
The fifth limb of yoga, I'm talking.
Oh, sense withdrawal?
Hmm?
Sense withdrawal.
Now, obviously you need that, right? If you want to meditate, you don't want your senses to be bombarding on your mind and your everything. If you smell something, you don't want it to be bombarding on your mind. Okay? So, turning these senses inward, that's pratyahara. And then there are these three stages of meditation called dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. What is dharana?
Concentration.
Initial focus, so to say. Right? Because your mind has to be brought into an initial state of focus and one-pointedness before you can get into meditation. Okay? So that's dharana. Dhyana is what? Dhyana is meditation. You know, continuing the process of meditation. And then samadhi is that final absorption. Alright? So, these are the eight limbs of yoga. And at this point, it's probably a good idea to now move to the slides so we can talk about some of these concepts here. So I had this background information. We already covered most of it. I wanted to talk about the definition of yoga. We did that. Abhyasa and Vairagya. I mentioned that. Kleshas. I think you already mentioned those. So I'm assuming you're familiar with that. What are the kleshas? You already mentioned those, that's what I'm saying. What are the kleshas? Afflictions, sufferings?
Oh, ignorance.
Ignorance, ego.
Attachment and aversions.
And?
Fear of death.
Abhinivesha. So in Sanskrit they are avidya, asmita, raga, dvesha, abhinivesha. So those are the five kleshas or afflictions. And we also talked about the Sankhya philosophy a little bit. Okay? 23 elements, that's what we talked about. Right? Okay? Now, this is something that people talk about when they talk about the mind. Okay, there are five states of the mind that are usually mentioned. And, you know, the most authoritative and most commonly referenced commentary on the Yoga Sutras is by a very ancient person. His name was Vyasa, V-Y-A-S-A, Vyasa. And every modern commentator uses his commentary as the basis, as the source material. Okay? So his commentary is the most authoritative commentary on the Yoga Sutras, Vyasa. And in the very first sutra, when he is giving the commentary, he says it's a good idea to understand these five states of the mind. So this comes from the commentary by Vyasa. So, what are the five states? One is the scattered state, which we know, you know, we are always in that state, okay? And the mind is always churning thoughts, mind is always running around, chattering, this and that. This is the most, this is the state where all the three gunas are constantly moving around. So, they're producing all these thoughts. The next state he calls is mudha, which is the dull state, which is sleepy, lethargic, dull. I call it couch potato-ness. All you want to do is to have a glass of beer, a whole bag of potatoes, and watch football and nothing else. Anybody ever do that? And the third state is when you're actually trying to sit and stay focused on something, you know, meditation or even listening to some music or doing some painting or something that you can get totally engrossed in. That's called a partially focused vikshipta mind, where it can stay focused for a short amount of time, but then it gets distracted very easily. Then the next state is one-pointed, where you are able to hold the focus on a single object for some length of time, but then again you can get distracted. Finally, the last state is the state of Nirodha, Niruddha state, where it is now totally one-pointed and focused, no distractions. Okay, so now, this is what I was telling Sarah. You know what? I didn't have time to elaborate on these sutras. Normally, you know, I will put a few bullet points on every slide so I can explain these things, but I never got the time. I just got too busy. So what I've done is to just list all the sutras that are related to the concept of meditation and samadhi. Okay? And through this audio discussion, we'll go through these. Is that okay? You can always refer back to the audio recording for these discussions. Okay, so the first stage of meditation, you can call it, is the dharana stage, where you are able to try to focus your mind on a single entity. Okay. Now, there are many, many techniques of dharana which are mentioned. There's a very well-known book. It's a very ancient book. It's called the Vijnana Bhairava Tantra, very ancient book. It lists 112 techniques for dharana. Minor variations here and there, but it lists 112. You can look it up. Okay, Vijnana Bhairava Tantra. And there are other books which lists many other, you know, forms of dharana. The idea is to use one of these techniques or a combination so that you're able to bring your mind to an initial state of focus. Because unless you do that, when you sit in meditation, you know, your mind is going to be running around much more violently. All right? How do you do the dharana? Most commonly, what are the practices that people do for dharana? Breath. Breath is a very commonly used element. It is freely available, but you just have to learn to focus your mind on the breath. What else can be used?
The sun.
The sun. You know, gazing at the sun. Yeah.
A mantra.
Mantra is. Eventually, that's meditation. You can do dharana also on a mantra, but commonly what they kind of describe is that mantra, you keep it for your meditation practice. For dharana, something other than a mantra. You can use a mantra also. That's perfectly okay. But for, it's easier to bring the mind to a one-pointed focus if you use like a candlelight, you know, gaze at a candlelight for a long time, gaze at the rising sun for a long time, listen to some sound for a long time, okay? Things like that. So there are multiple ways. Just listen to your breath, watch your breath, see how it feels in the nostrils when you breathe in and out. So those are some of the techniques that are used to bring your mind to that initial state of focus. It's called dharana state. All right? And from there you transition to your dhyana state or the meditation. So the definition here is the concentration or dharana is the confining of the mind within a limited mental area. It's whatever you want to call it. You can listen to some music for some time, you know, chant something loudly for some time. This is a very common mantra for dharana. People use this very commonly. Om Bhur Bhuvasi. They repeat this multiple times. Many people do that 108 times. Repeat this 108 times and then you transition to your meditation.
So since you said 108, we wanted to ask you why is it 108? Like, why is that used so often?
What's the significance of 108?
Yes.
Okay. You know, there are ancient texts in India called the Vedas. Mm-hmm. Anybody heard the term Vedas? Mm-hmm. They have a lot of information. Okay? All kinds of information. And some of the information is pretty mind-boggling. Is how, in those days, how they got this information. So one of the things that comes out, which is mentioned in the Vedas, is the distance between the earth and the moon. Listen to this carefully. The distance between the earth and the moon is 108 times the diameter of the moon. So guess what? In those days, without any instruments, they knew the diameter of the moon. Okay? And they know the distance between the earth and the moon, and they could calculate it is 108 times. I checked with my niece. She's an astrophysicist. She says it's accurate within 3%. The distance between earth and the sun, same way, is 108 times the diameter of the sun. Fascinating facts.
Is that like a constant in physics?
It's a physiological. I mean, it's a fact. It's a fact, right?
Right, but I mean, is it constant for all bodies that are?
Yes. Yes. Body? Yes. Yes.
That's fascinating.
That's amazing.
Okay. And then, of course, they have other things. You know, for example, if you go through the design of a temple, for example, in the ancient texts, they say you should lay down 108 bricks at the front of the temple in such and such format. When you use that fire ritual, you know, that fire pit that you make, it should have 108 bricks and laid out in a certain manner. There are nine planets? 12 planets, 9 planets.
No longer Pluto.
Pluto is
no longer counted.
Well, anyway, in the Indian culture, there are if it's 9 planets, each has 12 positions. Mm-hmm. If it has 12 planets, each has 9 positions. That multiplies to 108.
Oh.
Okay. No, it's 12 planets, 9 positions of each.
Yeah, we had just been wondering for a while, and we were like, we have to make sure we ask.
108, very significant number.
Mm-hmm.
Very significant. And there are others which, you know, there are many other ways you can look at it. See?
So fascinating.
Yeah.
Like, how did they know that? Like,
fascinating.
They were just mind-blowing.
Amazing stuff. Okay. Let's move on. Move on to the definition of dhyana, meditation. This is one thing, again, is one of those sentences I would like you to memorize. Okay? And I'm going to break the words into smaller words. So let's all repeat now. Tatra. Pratyaya. Ekatanata. Dhyanam. Tatra. Pratyaya. Ekatanata. Dhyanam. Okay, that's the definition of meditation. Alright. What's pratyaya? That's the main word here. The meaning of the words are pratyaya. Pratyaya is one word. Ekatanata is one word. Okay. So those are the only two words that define dhyanam. Dhyanam is meditation. What's pratyaya? Pratyaya is the content of the mind at any given time. Okay? Pratyaya is the content of the mind at any given time. Ekatanata means the ability to stretch that content for a long period of time. Ek means one, tan is to stretch. So the ability to stretch the content of the mind for a long period of time is meditation. Alright. So what do you mean by the content of the mind? So if I'm looking at Sarah, for example, right? What's the content of my mind at that time? An image of her face, right? That's the content of my mind. Some aspect of it, you know, some may be more visible than the rest, but that's the content. Now, according to this definition of meditation, can I maintain that same image in my mind for a long period of time without intrusion by anything else? No other thought should come. That's called meditation. What happens? Every moment there is a change, right? The moment I look at Sarah, that image comes up, guess what? She's a yoga instructor. She is going through these students, you know, for their teacher's training. And then constantly, you know, other thoughts will come in. Her face will go away nowhere in the background, somewhere in the background. That's what happens when you meditate.
Right. Taking away the ego of it.
Exactly.
The story that you have attached to it.
Exactly. That's what ego does. It brings up stuff from that memory. And completely clobbers our meditation. Okay, so that's dhyana, that's meditation, is to ability to concentrate on a single object for some length of time.
So you said concentration fluctuates between different aspects of the same object, but you don't want that to happen.
Like the then it can happen. Okay. We're coming to that aspect. Okay.
So at this point, that's still...
It's still there. And that I sense remains, you know, I am meditating, that's still there, that concept is still there. I've put these because they in the future sutras, you know, we'll get around these things, okay? So that's dhyana, meditation. And then samadhi is... Somebody wants to read the translation, English translation?
During contemplation, when consciousness only of the object of meditation remains and not of itself, the mind is samadhi.
Right. So, here, the only thing that remains in the mind is the object of meditation. Nothing else remains in the mind at that time. That's samadhi.
So you're just, you know, when you're walking, everything, you're just meditating, basically.
Well, you know, not necessarily. What do you mean by walking?
No, I was just saying. What?
No, I don't recommend walking meditation. You know. No, it's not a laughing matter, because the Buddhists, they do that walking meditation also. But in our tradition, we do a seated meditation, sitting meditation.
I've tried walking meditation and it doesn't work for me really.
Again, it's very individual, but the Buddhists do that.
But you're saying you don't do that.
I don't do that because it's not a part of the yoga tradition. It's a part of the Buddhist meditation tradition, but not a part of the yoga tradition. Patanjali's tradition is sitting meditation. Okay? Alright, so this is when even the eye sense gets dissolved. Okay? That. These are very broad definitions. We are going to get into more details as we go into the other sutras, right? Mm-hmm. You'll have these slides with you, so you don't have to worry about them. It's okay to make notes, but don't spend too much time if you can. But you know, if some people actually understand and learn better if they make their own notes, if that's the case, please go ahead, keep doing that. That's perfectly okay. Now, this is just a definition of the term sanyama. You know, so when you do all these three together on some object, that becomes sanyama. That's the term they use in the chapter 3. Remember, chapter 3 is all about what? What's chapter 3 about?
Magic. Our powers.
All the powers, all the supernormal powers that we can all attain through the practice of yoga. When it says through the practice of yoga, it's all through the practice of meditation. Through the practice of sanyama, which is the combination of dharana, dhyana and samadhi on some aspects, and then it'll tell you what you should meditate on to get what as a result. Okay, that's all chapter 3 is about. So we have dharana, dhyana and samadhi. And when they are practiced together on a single object, on something, then it becomes sanyama.